Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Brooks Miller, Executive Vice President of Creator Marketing at Edelman and United Entertainment Group. Joining me today is Amy Webb, CEO of the Future Today Strategy Group. In her role, Amy pioneered a unique quantitative modeling approach and data-driven foresight methodology that identifies signals of change and emerging patterns very early, identifying white spaces, opportunities, and threats early enough for action. Regarded as one of the most important voices in the futures of technology, Amy is the award-winning author of four books, including the international bestseller, The Big Nine, and the most recent, The Genesis Machine, which examines the futures of gene editing, biotech, and synthetic biology. Amy was also named to Edelman's first ever list of the 50 AI creators you need to know. Welcome, Amy. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. It's nice to see you today. I'm so glad to have you here on Trustmakers.
I'm delighted to be here and was very grateful to be included on the list.
Well, we're happy to have you. So, Amy, you describe yourself as a quantitative futurist. Can you please tell us what exactly is a quantitative futurist? Also, how did you get into this field?
A futurist is somebody who studies emerging signals and trends and uncertainties in order to predict or forecast what might happen in the future. And that results in scenarios. And really, the point of a scenario is to get back to strategy. So if we can figure out what might happen based in data, then we can make better decisions in the present. The quantitative piece of this comes from my background, which is economics and game theory. There are people who practice strategic foresight in a more creative and imaginative way. Our organization focuses much more, whenever we can, on rigorous quantitative and qualitative data, using a lot of frameworks and trying to get as accurate as we possibly can.
So, combination of data and future work. How did you get into this work?
So interestingly enough, when I was a middle school student, I was in a gifted and talented program in my middle school, and they pulled us out to do different activities. And I was on something called the Future Problem Solvers of America, which I don't think exists anymore. But at the time, it was a competitive team. You would have topic to research. At that point, it was like acid rain. And you were supposed to come up with all different plausible ways that that might turn out and then, you know, hopefully get to solutions or strategies for that. But it was a ton of research. I was in a library every single weekend from morning until night, researching and writing. And only did I realize much later in life that what I was being trained to do when I was 11 was identify signals, trends, uncertainties, and write scenarios. So that really planted the seed. And I've always been interested in the different facets that make up strategic foresight. So researching, modeling, writing, some of it is speaking and convincing. And my career path has taken a couple of different twists and turns that started with law school and one point included journalism. But I eventually found my way here about 20 years ago.
So love of research and data started at a very young age.
Technically, I wanted to be Solicitor General when I was in middle school, but I'm happy where I wound up.
Pushing now to today, your work at Future Strategy Group is largely focused on helping organizations and leaders across institutions, you know, identify and address future opportunities and threats and crises. What do you feel like are the biggest future threats to society, to institutional trust? We obviously care about trust a ton at Edelman, but what are the big threats that we need to be thinking about?
Sure. So at Future Today Strategy Group, again, our goal here is both foresight and strategy, which means trying to anticipate what the future might look like, but getting those decisions correct in the present. And I think one of the biggest threats to all of that is this continued sense of what I call FOMA, which is not FOMO. FOMO was the fear of missing out. FOMA is the fear of missing anything. It just sort of represents this moment that we're living through where novelty is continually, you know, the new normal. And I think there's this crushing amount of deep uncertainty that has made it challenging for anybody to make any decision. And that paralysis in the present has led to a distinct lack of long-term planning, which is a huge, huge threat. you know, you can, I hate to bring up the pandemic since it's now been 5 years, but also it's been 5 years and we don't have, you know, a direction consistently that we're headed into as a country, but that's similar of a lot of countries around the world. The pendulum swung pretty dramatically from let's come up with diagnostics and vaccines to suddenly maybe we shouldn't vaccinate anymore, which I'm not advocating, but that very much has to do with trust and sentiment and the sense of everything is always changing. Artificial intelligence is not a singular technology. It's an umbrella term for many different technologies. And here too, business and government sort of didn't do the long-term planning. AI is not new. It's been with us now for many decades. And so here the challenge is that everybody waited to show up at the AI party. And now everybody feels like they're so late, they're having to scramble to make decisions. In reality, artificial intelligence is a really long horizon technology, but it's this fear of the unknown that's causing leaders to make decisions they probably would not have made if they weren't feeling that pressure.
So our most recent 2025 trust barometer found that we are in a crisis of grievance. And I really love the word grievance. I think it really encapsulates emotionally where people are in this world that we live in currently. And we saw that respondents are increasingly worried about things like cyber attacks, info wars, losing their jobs to automation. And then in most developed countries, less than 1 in 5 say that the next generation will be better off, which I found staggering. I'm a mother myself, and that's the inverse of what you hope for the next generation. You want your children to do better than you. So as someone who studies the future, is this in line with your findings? What do you make of this data?
So I think that that characterization is spot on. And just like you, I think that crisis of grievance really, really does a good job of describing the circumstances that we're in right now. Look, every generation has had to deal with what feels like a future that's coming faster than you expected or anticipated. And that can cause a sense of unease. But I think in this particular circumstance, we have a sort of polycrisis, which is geopolitical and economic in nature. You know, there's always rumblings, but we haven't sort of had these small inflection points like we've had recently with regard to inflation, possible recession. I hate to be a downer here, but, you know, the conflict in Russia and Ukraine and Israel, I mean, you know, there's a lot happening. At the same time, we have new technologies that are both exciting and scary to a lot of people. So on the one hand, you know, the promise of AI means increased productivity and maybe an easier way of doing certain jobs. On the one hand, potentially also means job loss, or if not outright job loss, pretty significant changes to jobs that are going to require upskilling and more school. That's pretty scary. And on top of that, we have pretty big changes happening in the sciences. We've got new types of genetic medicine and alternatives to treatments and surgeries, which basically means that change is coming at us now from every direction. And I think typically, if you look back through history, when civilizations have encountered periods like these, usually we're not feeling optimistic. The sentiment is usually like, this is bad. And I'm not sure how we're going to get through this. I think the best thing to keep in mind right now is that we all still have agency. I don't believe in destiny or astrology or anybody who can, you know, definitively predict the future. I cannot definitively predict the future. There are too many variables at play at any given time. But that's a good thing. If the future is not predetermined, it means that we have the ability to shape it with the decisions that we make in the present.
I also feel that in previous generations, we didn't have the massive amount of communication capacity to be able to talk to one another at scale the way that we do, and honestly, to freak out with one another at scale and the way that we do. So, you know, maybe in previous generations, people were this worried, but we weren't able to at scale, speak about it on Twitter, on Instagram, on TikTok, and communicate so deeply and so rapidly and with such virality so frequently. So I think there is something to be said for that, because it does feel like such a wave of anxiety. But, you know, when you only had a horse and a buggy to go speak to one another, to go connect with one another, to go share news, it's harder to have grievance at mass scale.
I agree with you. But if you go back to yesteryear, the original social media as it was launching, the late 2000s and early 2010s, look, I was an original Twitter user. And in the earliest days of Twitter, in fact, I was at South by Southwest when Twitter launched, when it was a company name that didn't have vowels. It was just TWTTR. I was an original Facebook and Twitter user. And at the start of all of this, it was much more joyful. You know, if you go back in time, it was fun to be connected. And yes, we were sharing information, but the information was like, hey, I just saw this cool new thing, or like, you're never going to believe this really interesting, you know, whatever it is. And it took a while, but that devolved, that community, that sense of community that I had changed. And I think part of what we're left with now is the sort of dystopian hellscape that a lot of the platforms have turned into, which, to your point, has made people feel like, in some cases, the world is worse off than it actually is, because there's a negative, hateful, spiteful echo chamber. You know, it's ironically, we're living in the year 2025, but it's hard to figure out how to find that community that we got accustomed to interacting with online. I mean, at this point, I'm sort of, I have like 30 WhatsApp groups and Signal groups, you know, and everything kind of has reverted back to text messaging. Again, I don't think that's forever. I think we're going to swing back at some point. Unfortunately, I think we live in a world of algorithmic determinism, and the algorithms have determined that hateful content gets more traction than people saying, hey, look at this cool new thing. And that's true even of platforms like TikTok.
In early January, you published an article on Harvard Business Review about why living intelligence is the next big thing. What is living intelligence first? And then why should business leaders pay attention to living intelligence? So a two-parter.
Living intelligence is the convergence of three general purpose technologies: artificial intelligence, advanced sensors, and biotechnology. And the convergence between those three general purpose technologies results in new kinds of systems that are capable of sensing, learning, adapting, and evolving using all these different types of data that are produced. So this living intelligence represents a next era of technology that are intended to make decisions and interact and help us in new ways, which will be both incredibly beneficial and potentially extremely harmful. Living intelligence will become a platform for enormous amounts of productivity and new innovations. So imagine advanced sensors and biology combining to collect significantly more information about you, which could lead to a near-term future in which, rather than taking medication, you're actually ingesting little sensors that can wrap around your neurons and or wrap around cells to steer them into your body sort of self-repairing, you know, in some cases, not every case. This is what will finally help robotics take off. There's a lot of reasons why we've had robots for literally 100 years now. And the closest that anybody has ever come to a butler-style robot is a Roomba in their house. We're going to start to see that change as well, because we have all of these new forms of data ingestion that can help make decisions. So there's so much coming. And now is the time for businesses to start preparing for that future, because living intelligence touches every single industry, every single one, whether you make paper or you make potato chips or cars or whatever it might be. Every single industry will be impacted.
How does it touch paper?
So there's something called metamaterial. Metamaterials are new kinds of materials produced because of living intelligence that don't follow the typical rules of physics, so, or biology or anything else. Imagine a piece of paper that is no longer analog. So if you apply heat or if you apply cold, it might on its own fold into a predetermined origami shape. Or imagine a piece of paper that can also act as an insulation. So heat might actually trigger a cooling property. So why would you care about self-folding origami or self-cooling paper? Because if you are a consumer packaged goods company and you have to transport something like a, you know, something that's frozen or something that must be kept cold, that requires a very long cold chain and it's super expensive and it's not great for the environment. It's complicated supply chain logistics, everything else. If you could just package whatever that is in a new type of metamaterial, let's say coated paper, suddenly that supply chain becomes much easier for you and your costs come down, margins go up. And on the self-folding paper, that's going to help everything from, you know, space flight, you know, where you need things to sort of self-fold into different shapes for different reasons, to cool party tricks at your, you know, your daughter's next birthday party.
It's a very different game of rock, paper, scissors in this new world.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You would have to add a new category.
I know. I don't think scissors can cut paper in this new world. That's crazy and so cool. It really is kind of breaking my brain. I'm also realizing that I should probably go back to school and learn a couple of new things.
Well, I'm happy you brought that up because I don't like the word upskilling. I feel like upskilling is inherently condescending because it, you know, reskilling, upskilling. I think we have to learn how to talk about people and work and the future differently. Because on the one hand, you may have this sense that like, oh, no, I don't know anything. I've got to go back to school or I'm totally... this is bad for me. What's happening is your curiosity is shutting down. And I think we need to incentivize people through curiosity and treat this as an opportunity versus something that'll be painful or challenging to learn and try new things. And I think there's an enormous window of opportunity for people who work in human resources and talent development to adopt a different language for this going, all of this going forward.
That's such a lovely push and an interesting way of framing it, because I also think that creates such an opportunity to de-incentivize the fear around a lot of this and give people opportunity to be more excited and more curious around how this could make their lives better.
Going back to the sort of grievance situation, we need to stop fearing the future, which is what's happening right now. The future is not inherently scary or great. There is no dystopia or utopia. You know, it shows up again, like... using the building blocks of the present day. So it's less about like coming up with some techno-utopian future or some Black Mirror-style dystopian future. If we shouldn't like emotionally attach ourselves to fear what's coming. Instead, we should be practical and pragmatic and just like, you know, let's take the data we've got access to and figure out where we want to go and, you know, get there.
With all of this future talk, AI, we work with brands, companies, thought leaders, leaders. What are they getting wrong in this space?
Unfortunately, I think so many brands, so many companies waited to start paying attention to artificial intelligence that now there's this scramble to catch up. And because this is such a challenging area, I mean, there, you can get multiple PhDs in artificial intelligence and related fields, that people are latching on to the buzzwords because the buzzwords are what make it easier to understand. So right now, you know, if last year was all about generative AI, this year is all about agentic AI. And honestly, those two terms really do water down what's actually happening and what's possible. So I think one big challenge here is continually looking forward because there is no end. It's not like you go through your generative AI transformation and now you're done. I mean, like, I can guarantee you that 5 years from now, we are not going to be talking about a large language model. Just like today, we don't talk about the internet or HTTP. You know, we've moved past that. What I would love to see brands doing is a better job of staying ahead of what's happening right now. And that means getting beyond the buzzwords, getting a little bit more familiar with what AI is, what it's not, how it works, so that you're prepared and attuned to the signals that are starting to unfold.
In the article that I was looking up about you and what a quantitative futurist is, the person who was defining what that was in relation to you was talking about that you had a philosophy around the idea of studying this in technology. You can't just be studying 5-10 years ahead. You need to be looking 75-100 years ahead.
Well, that's another good point. That's another great point for brands, especially. I know everybody wants to know, like, when does artificial general intelligence come? Or when exactly on which date do we need to really be looking forward to? Because that's when the thing will happen. Artificial intelligence, there's so many different facets of it. There are different areas of it. You know, there's something called computer vision. There's something called spatial awareness and spatial computing. There are multi-agent systems. There's a lot. And because there are so many different pieces to this AI puzzle, that means that their trajectory isn't predetermined. So there could be an inflection point tomorrow in, let's say, generative biology. So this is combining AI with biology that, believe it or not, could then catapult, as insane as this sounds, the metaverse. Remember that? Remember metaversal technology?
Yes.
So like there are all these complex interdependencies, which means that there's no way to accurately predict how many trillions of dollars AI will generate on like this day in the future or whatever it might be. So again, if you're a brand and you're sort of trying to make a timeline or figure out we're going to wait until X happens, that's a really dangerous game to play. You need to look at your own organization and the data that you've got access to and what you're trying to do and sort of start there and mirror that and your strategy to how various different developments in AI are unfolding.
I love it. I'm hearing it's an always on practice. It's not take one AI training and we're done. And that it's not a reactive study. It's a future study. And it's not a 5-year future. It's a 20, 50, 7,500 year future. So, so helpful. I think those are really helpful takeaways for our brands, any brand, anyone listening. So outside of your future today strategy group work, you are a professor, an adjunct professor at NYU. So your students, young people, what are they perceiving and thinking about when it comes to the biggest thrust of society today? You know, what advice would your students give to the leaders of these organizations that you work with at Future Today?
So my role as a professor at NYU Stern School of Business is a very much a side hustle, but I do it for a couple of reasons. One, there just aren't enough people trained in foresight. And even if you don't go into that full time, the courses in the MBA program, every leader needs to have some foundation in strategic foresight at this point to be able to make decisions. So I, from my point of view, every single business person out there, every leader has a little bit of finance and maybe a little bit of accounting. They understand how to read a P&L. Every single leader should also have a foundation in strategic foresight. It is, at this point, table stakes, not a nice thing to have. It's a must have, which is why I developed and teach the program. But it's wonderful to be around MBA students. And Stern is just such a great school because it attracts top talent from around the world. So I get to interact with people that are early career to mid-career from literally all over the world. And it has been fascinating watching that group of people change over the past 10 years. The very first thing I do on every class is we do these basically 3-word introductions. So I have everybody go around the room. They say their name. They say what NYU has a couple of different programs. So like which program that they're in at Stern. But then 1 word to describe how they are currently feeling about the future. And it has been I collect data from every class, every time, every semester. Super interesting. It went from, I don't know, people about 10 years ago. So what would that have been? 2015, wildly optimistic and almost like fluffy, you know, to very dark and deep and dystopian and terrible. And now it's more practical. It's so interesting. The last semester that we did this, the answers were very, very pragmatic. Like the future is a puzzle. or it is a problem to be solved. We oftentimes have people using more than one word. But it was more like, I got this, I'm going to do it. Or it was a little more adaptable, agile, words like that to describe how people were feeling, which I think is kind of great because it gives you a sense of where these future leaders' heads are at. And they may be worried about the economy and their ability to do better than their parents, but I feel like they're up for the task. You know, I feel like they're ready to push up their sleeves and get to work. That is a pretty big change, I would say, over the past year. Is this like, and I think that runs a little bit counter to the narratives we've heard about Gen Z. And, you know, which is at least the people that I'm interacting with are like, you know, teach us what you know. Let us push up our sleeves and then get out of our way so that we can do the work, which I think is awesome.
They're a very misunderstood generation, at least from the data that we pulled around them. They contain multitudes.
They sure do.
So, Amy, I hear that you have just released your 18th annual Tech Trends Report. Can you tell us a little bit about your findings from that?
I could, but it would take a while because this year's report is 1,000 pages long. So this is our most comprehensive report that we've ever put together. Let me preface this by saying our trends are not totally different every single year. So we are always tracking trends that is part and parcel of strategic foresight. Sometimes there are new ones, sometimes others fall off the list, but we're always updating them. So a good chunk of that report, I think we have more than 700 technology trends that span every area of technology and many different industries are the trends. But the analysis portion of that points to some, you know, new macro findings that that have a little bit to do with living intelligence, but also trust and, you know, how we think companies can and should seize opportunities in the future. The difference, I think, between our trend reports and other reports that exist is that ours rely heavily on data versus conversations. And at the end of the day, if you can't, trends are foundational. They don't predict the future. They tell you the direction that the future is headed in. So it's kind of like having a map. If you use our trend report, that's your map to the future. You want your map to have the correct roads and stop signs and lights rather, right? You know, because otherwise you wind up going in the wrong place. So I think that's one unique facet of the report that we put together every year. And it is free for anybody to download and use. You can go to ftsg.com/trends.
That's all the time we have. Thank you, Amy, for your insights and expertise. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.